There's a tract of land in Platte County. It looks peaceful enough. There's forest and a lot of open space. But there's an invisible battle going on here, one of many in an ongoing conflict that happens everywhere a community is growing. On the one side, developers, often civic planners, want to turn unused land into a neighborhood, or roads, or utilities, or school buildings. On the other, some citizens who see more benefit in keeping things natural. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Gina Kaufman, and today on KCUR Central Standard, we're examining that tension and asking what it really means to have, or to use, undeveloped land. KCUR intern Tom Taylor takes us up to Kansas City's Northland.
Running south from Berry Road to 68th Street, there's a snaking concrete path. To the west is Line Creek, with neighborhoods in the background, and to the east are hills and ravines covered in trees. About 600 acres of woodland sits undeveloped, with the exception of that concrete path, which is Line Creek Trail. It's an unusually warm day for January, so the birds are out and the creek has thawed in some parts.
So like in the summer, when you're standing right here, you don't hear anything. It just doesn't feel like Kansas City. You know, it just doesn't feel like you're in the middle of the city.
That's Julie Stutterheim, a local mom who loves spending time out here with her kids. She's not alone, as the trail gets used for bicycling, walking dogs, and if you're like Julie, you might stray from the path and explore nature. But the days are numbered for the area around Line Creek Trail because of the needs of the Park Hill School District.
The number of students has grown every year for 34 consecutive years. We're near almost 12,000 students now. And so every year we get closer and closer to the need for additional classrooms.
That's Paul Kelly, assistant superintendent. The district acquired 272 acres of the land in April of last year. Plans for it include a new elementary school and a separate permanent overflow facility for high school students. Currently, more than 200 elementary students are being taught in mobile units, so it's pretty urgent. Construction on that building is set for April. But when you buy this much land, it doesn't hurt to think long range. Kelly points to a big blob of red on a map of the property.
All of this red would be master planned for a third full-fledged high school, which there is some uncertainty about whether or not the district would ever grow that large. And so, and before we would commit to building any of this, the largest portion of that area, we would actually have to have an enrollment triggered.
So Julie Stutterheim, that mom who loves to explore this area with her kids, when she heard about the district's plans 5 months ago, she wanted to do something to stop it. She started a website called Last KC Forest and, with four others, is petitioning the school district, state and local governments, as well as the Missouri Department of Conservation to preserve the woodland area surrounding the Line Creek Trail. So far, the online petition has collected just over 6,000 signatures. Inside her home, Stutterheim lays out an aerial photograph of the woodlands and points to two large swaths of tree-splattered land just to the west of where the new schools would be built.
So this is what I've asked them to do is, can you designate these two areas as conservation areas? Don't build the road so it like blazes through this forest.
Building on previously undeveloped land means access roads need to be built and utilities need to be extended. In this case, the city is asking the district to build a four-lane parkway, which is part of the city's long-range plan for a Line Creek Parkway, extending north from Inglewood past Highway 152. On this, Stutterheim and the school district see eye to eye. Here's Assistant Superintendent Paul Kelly again.
Frankly, if it was just to service the elementary school and the lead campus, we wouldn't need a full four-lane parkway. There just isn't that much traffic.
Joe Rexwinkel works in the Department of City Planning and Development. His division works with applicants to comply with city policies and codes.
Typically, the city builds these roads. In this case, because they need immediate access to the elementary school, the school district's building the parkway.
Rexwinkel says that while they push for as much tree preservation as they can get,
however, you know, that has to be balanced with the operational needs of the district.
Julie Stutterheim acknowledges that the district needs a new elementary school and that she's a little late to the game on this. She had to hear about it from a neighbor to become aware of the plans in the first place. Most of the work she's done has been to raise awareness in her community. Still, Paul Kelly says the district isn't backing down.
We can't just say, oh, well, we'll donate it, or oh, we're never going to use it, because we just can't do that. We paid for this land for the purpose of schools for our kids. We use taxpayer dollars.
Stutterheim says her kids are the reason she's doing this.
I've got two kids, and if we start to just develop all the places like this, like, they won't even have a choice, you know, whether they're going to be city kids or wildlife kids or whatever.
In the meantime, Stutterheim is working with other local environmental groups and lobbying public officials.
That was our now former intern, Tom Taylor, reporting. And joining us now in the studio, or actually in at KBIA in Columbia, to help us understand what's at stake when people clash over what to do with public land is Hank Stelzer. He teaches at the University of Missouri. And Hank, thanks for being with us.
Hey, good morning, Ryan.
So you heard that report that we were just listening to, a story of tree preservation versus the needs of a school district. Is that a pretty typical story in development questions?
Unfortunately, it is. As we go through the urban wildland areas, as we encroach upon nature, it always becomes a challenge. But in the case here, it reminds me a little bit of Little Creek Nature Area over in the Ferguson-Florissant, where I grew up nearby.
Over in St. Louis.
Yeah, over in Florissant. Go ahead.
No, what reminds you about that?
Well, they have it's about 100 acres, and it just sits north of I-70, matter of fact, right along I-270, and west of West Florissant there in the Ferguson-Florissant School District. Like I say, about 100 acres, it was probably 1960. The area was still relatively open, much like what you see here in Park Hills, but it rapidly expanding, urbanization. They had an area that's designated for expansion, the district did, and they've kept it, but they've kept it basically green and turned it into a nature area. So a lot of the elementary schools and high schools use this as a hands-on nature area where they can explore. Mm-hmm. A little bit different here, where I see the school district is wanting to build buildings, but I think, you know, it would be a perfect fit in some respects, as far as you wouldn't have transportation issues. The students would be able to just really literally walk out and engage with nature. And I did hear the concerns what the landowners, the homeowners were saying with the existing tree cover. It looks like, from what I've looked at the plans, that one where they have those two large swaths between the planned facilities, it makes sense for that to happen.
So, I mean, this is a particular case, but just generally speaking, it sounds like this is not so unusual that there's a suburban area that maybe was less developed a generation or two ago, but now there's this need, there's the changing needs of a community. And what are the questions that a school district or civic planners have to ask in a situation like this?
You know, just trying to find that balance, trying to meet their needs, but also be sensitive to those, you know, to the remaining green spaces that are out there, and then look at the particular, you know, what the land gives. There's, in this case here, you've got a significant creek running through there, and we always want to keep our green infrastructure intact as much as possible, mainly because it makes it easier to maintain green space than build concrete pipes and deal with stormwater mitigation downstream.
Do you have a sense of how much undeveloped land exists in Missouri? How much space are we talking about?
Wow, that's a good one. No, not off the top of my head. I know that we lose the equivalent of about the size of Columbia, Missouri, about every month.
Wow, that seems like a lot.
Yeah, it seems like a lot, and it is. I mean, we've got 45 million acres here in the state of Missouri, but it is significant, particularly around our urban areas. I mean, the sprawl that we're getting, it's the challenge to build up and build rather than build out. But then you have, like we have here in Columbia, we've seen a tremendous growth vertical in downtown Columbia, which is great in some respects. It saved us, slowed down the urban sprawl, but now it's put a tremendous strain on our existing infrastructure, both our utilities and our stormwater. So, you know, you can't have it. If you're going to take it away one place, you're going to have to pay for it somewhere else.
Yeah. Talking with Hank Stelzer, who teaches at the University of Missouri, also has the title of State Forestry Extension Specialist. What does that mean, mm-hmm. Hank?
Well, I work with landowners across the state, but in this case in urban areas, work with our community foresters, Department of Conservation. They've got an excellent group that work in the metro areas. You've got two really good ones there in the KC area.
Well, so I guess one of the questions I have is, you heard the concerns of the citizen in that story, Julie Steyerheim, about wanting to preserve as best she could this the nature, the greenery. Is there a win-win in situations like these? Are there things you can do to mitigate the negative impact of development while still preserving what people like Julie want more of?
I think there is. It really is, a key is going to be with the high school and working with the developer, you know, choosing the right developer, the right construction.
And how would you know? Like, what kind of things would the right developer do?
It would just be a matter of the school working with, I would say, get the community foresters involved, get their input, what they'd look for as far as how they would minimize the impact of the construction of the buildings, you know, where they're going to have their, in the construction of something this large, there's going to have to be, you know, a concentration area of materials and equipment. So just the proper placement of that, being sensitive to the stream, both the perennial stream there, but also those ephemeral streams. Those are the ones that, you know, are just the valleys, but they have water in extreme events. Mm-hmm. So you just got to have the right buffers around there, both during construction as well as afterwards.
You know, I think there's sort of an underlying assumption sometimes that if we don't build, if we don't put in neighborhoods or school buildings on these sites, then the land will remain pristine and available for kids to play on and animals to live in. Is that necessarily true, especially in these suburban areas like this?
Boy, I tell you, as these parcels, these green parcels stay longer, the pressure for them to be developed is just grows, particularly as the area develops. So, you know, if I was in the area, if I had my choice between another subdivision and a school district, at least trying to work with the neighbors, I'd choose working with the school district. At least you're going to maintain some green area, as opposed to a developer. Not all developers are bad, but I'm just saying they're going to maximize, you know, to get their most out of their return on investment.
Right. You could do worse than a school district developing.
Yeah, you could do worse.
Are there other areas in the Kansas City area that you know of that where this sort of discussion has played out?
No, not really. This was brought to my attention when Matt came to me and asked me to come on the show.
Our producer, Matthew Hamilton.
Yeah. And then I really just kind of said, well, I need to get educated. So I looked at that, pulled the plan down, and looked at the area. And I really hadn't had time to get up with the community foresters for the Department of Conservation.
What are the risks, or maybe the right question is the costs of developing land like this? What goes away? What might you lose?
Well, you're fragmenting. That's 600 acres up. You're breaking it up. It could make it harder, depending upon the species that are there, for going, if they're using this as a corridor from one area to the other. Although, looking at this, there's quite a bit of urban development really on all four sides, not only the property that we're talking about, but all the way up to the north.
You know, we've been using this term undeveloped land. I think that probably means a lot of different things. As you think about it in the broadest sense, does the state of Missouri have a problem with its management of undeveloped land, or are we doing pretty well?
I think we're doing pretty well. I mean, again, where you're going to see it is in these urban areas as we run out. But, you know, we're a conservation-minded state, more so. I've worked in a number of states across the country in my career, and really the citizens value green space. They're very passionate about it, as you can tell from this instance. But they also, they're supportive, right or left, it doesn't matter. Case in point, when every county in the state of Missouri in the November election by 80% approved the soil tax for parks and conservation areas.
And as someone who manages forests in your work or is an expert in forestry, when we talk about letting land go undeveloped, do you think that they understand even what that means? Do you think we have a common consensus around what it is to develop land or to leave it as is?
Well, nature isn't static. We're seeing what we call succession, you know, development, the slow, gradual replacement of one plant and animal community with another as either the land, the forest grows, or there's outside pressures put on from urbanization, so it doesn't really remain static. But for keeping it undeveloped and as much green space as possible, I think that is a good thing.
That's Hank Stelzer. He's the State Forestry Extension Specialist and Associate Professor at Mizzou. Hank, thanks so much for spending a few minutes with us.
Hey, no problem.
Coming up, we take a look at a problem that isn't new, but which statistics say may be growing, suicide among young people in the metro. We'll try to figure out why and what to do about it. I'm Brian Ellison, KCUR Central Standard. We'll be right back. The numbers cause concern. Suicide is the third leading cause of death in teenagers nationwide, and contributing risk factors like anxiety and depression are rising nationally. But honestly, even if the number of young people who died by suicide were small, maybe only one in your school or your community or your family, that would be too many. I'm Brian Ellison in for Gina Kaufman. Today on KCUR Central Standard, we're talking about suicide among young people. It seems to be behind recent increases in those numbers, including here in the metro. We'll also talk about what some people in the community are doing to prevent teen suicides. People like Dr. Steve Arkin, welcome to Central Standard.
Thank you.
So, Steve, you're a neurologist, but you've become a leader in these local efforts. You've come to all this for the most personal of reasons. And I wonder if you wouldn't mind starting by telling us about Jason.
Yes, and thank you for having me here today. Jason was our son. He died by suicide back in 2015. He was a junior at Northwestern Engineering at the time. And he suffered from depression and anxiety and his perfectionism. And he told us about that when he was 12 years old. So for over 8 years, 9 years actually, we were doing everything we could. Psychologists, psychiatrists, numerous drugs and other modalities to try to help him out. But eventually he did succumb to his disease. Just a marvelous, well-educated person who had this illness, this brain disease.
Did you have what you would call warning signs? Were you afraid this might be the outcome?
We did. He actually was very forthcoming about what was going on in his life and that he did have suicidal ideation. He called it flashes, but he told us that he would never act upon them. And he would go into these stages where he would become isolated and we would become concerned. In fact, we had him taken out of school after his sophomore year of college, and over that summer went through intensive psychotherapy and brought back and aced his exams and did well for several months before he passed away.
It sounds like you and your family were very aware of the situation. You had some ideas about how to address it, and yet your son still died by suicide. What was the impact of that on your family?
The impact was incredible. It's like how can this happen? And we get tremendous support, but still a devastating event, and we still think about it every single day, and our efforts are brought about because of that and trying to prevent others from suffering through the same situation that we did.
Well, you have responded to that tragedy in your family by trying to help others, and I want to talk about those efforts. But first, let me bring into the conversation Murray Rose Williams, who covers education for the Kansas City Star. Murray, welcome back.
Thank you for having me here.
And you've been reporting on teen suicide in the metro. The numbers do seem to be growing.
Yeah, the numbers do seem to be growing. When we did our report, our research showed that 2017, that there were the greatest number of teen suicides in the history of them being recorded in the state of Missouri. That number was 77. The last time, the last rate was that in 1987, there were 66. So, and as we were reporting, as we were researching, there were teen suicides actually happening as we were doing our research, which was like, we couldn't do it fast enough.
And how did you find out about those suicides? I mean, how do you as a reporter get information to really document the problem?
Well, as a newspaper, let me just say, as a newspaper, normally we do not report suicides unless they happen in a public place. Mm-hmm. In this instance, what was happening is social media suicide is not a secret thing anymore because kids get on social media and they start talking about it. And when things start trending on social media, which we follow, then we were seeing that, you know, this was happening. And that's what led us to write about them.
What leads to that that standard of reporting to say that you normally don't report on suicides? Why not?
Well, traditionally, I think it's always been thought that if you talk about suicide, it breeds suicide. And I think that's what has led newspapers to not report on suicides. So, but I must say that I've talked about this with my editors, and we are actually having discussions about how we deal with them going into the future. And we're going to talk about whether we want to continue that.
Because there's a range of views on whether that is true, that talking about suicide actually leads to suicide.
That's right. There are two sides of every story. I mean, and the debate, in some instances, people will say, you know, it's a contagion, that if you talk about suicide, it's going to allow make others commit suicide. But then the experts are now beginning to say that that is not the case, that there is no evidence that supports that.
So the reporting you and a couple of your colleagues at The Star did back in December, you told the stories of a handful of students who died by suicide. And I have to say a lot of them seemed like they had a lot going for them. High academic achievements, stable family, similar to the story that that Steve has shared of his own son.
That's what makes this so disturbing. I mean, these kids that we wrote about, these were kids who were excelling, who were engaged and involved in school, yet they took their own lives. And the parents that I talked to, many of them talked about this idea of perfectionism that Steve just mentioned, and how social media feeds into that, these kids see, when people post on Facebook, for example, they post the best of their lives. They post themselves on vacation and everything is beautiful and wonderful. And if young people are constantly seeing that and they're going, well, my life's not like that, I must be a loser. My life's not that grand. So they've talked about how that they believe that contributed in some ways to this whole idea of I can't be perfect.
I want to talk more as our show goes on today about some of those factors and maybe how the changing culture that youth are part of maybe is contributing in a different way to the causes of suicide. But Steve, I want to come back to the way that you have responded to this and the way that you have joined with another family to do something about it. Would you tell us about the Speak Up Foundation?
What we did is we decided that we needed to honor some of the people that have died by suicide in a way that would be positive. And one of the things that we figured out over time was that people in middle schools and high schools, they are under tremendous stress, and we wanted to give a positive message. And that's why we developed a foundation called Speak Up. And it's called Suicide Prevention, Education, and Awareness for Kids United as Partners, a community effort through parents and through teachers and administrators through the churches to try to build up a community to give a positive message about mental wellness instead of mental illness.
And so what are some of the activities that Speak Up puts together?
So we do a number of fundraising events to try to bring about a program free to the schools within the metro area that allows for materials to get into the schools with these positive messages of inclusion rather than exclusion, so that people do not become isolated, that development of hopelessness and helplessness, so that they can come together and they can look for the substance of what is mental illness itself, to educate themselves, for one, and then also to look for the activity, the behaviors in the speech and know what to say. So we instill the Signs of Suicide program into that effort, and we have various posters and other ways of bringing those materials into the schools.
Murray, let me ask you, what is the impact of these sort of prevention efforts in the schools? This is one of several efforts that are being made.
Well, I can say that there is a law in Kansas that requires schools to actually train their teachers and staff on how to talk to kids and parents. It's the Jason Flack Act. And there is also a law afoot in Missouri to do a similar thing. And 18 states across the country have similar measures. So I think schools are beginning to open their doors. They're recognizing that there is a problem. They're letting organizations like Speak Up come in. So it's having a tremendous impact on how schools deal with suicide and how you know, parents are able to deal with suicide amongst their children.
And Steve, give us a sample of some of what that message is that you're trying to get out. So, for example, what are the warning signs that you encourage parents to be watching for?
What they should be watching for are changes in behavior, changes in sleep, changes in diet. If they are going to their room and becoming more isolated, if they're playing more on the computer where they used to not be, if all of a sudden they get excited about something that otherwise is out of character for them. The other thing that we also instill upon people is that you have to be able to ask the question, are you thinking about harming yourself? Are you thinking about killing yourself? I think that people don't understand that they're not going to all of a sudden think, oh, well, that's a great idea. No, it's going to substantiate what they're already thinking, and then they can bring about that conversation to work on stemming off that situation.
So you would say that we're not really helping things either as newspapers or as teachers in a classroom by avoiding this topic.
I think that in a way that substantiates the stigma against it. What the studies actually show is that kids are aware of this, and it actually doesn't help. It's very important that we dispel that stigma, is that it's another illness. It's an illness of the brain, just like an illness like diabetes or cancer, that you would talk about that. But we can't talk about suicide. We can't talk about mental illness.
Murray, as you've done this reporting, I mean, what are the systemic issues that come up? There are warning signs for individual youth, but are there broader issues that you think are contributing? You mentioned social media, for example.
Well, yeah, there's the social media, and then there's all the pressures you know, that we, again, the perfection. And also, I did a story some years ago where I talked with psychiatrists about, and I don't want to blame parents, but how we raise our children. And the children who have never dealt with adversity, you know, everybody wins, and helicopter parents. And some of the research that I've done lately, that came up again, where kids have are not used to dealing with adversity. And so when they're faced with it, they don't know how to handle it. And so they take a long-term solution for a short-term problem, and too often that's catastrophic, like suicide.
I want to mention at least a couple times during this show that there is, of course, a national suicide hotline number that people can call. It's available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. That number, if there's something that you need to call someone or you know someone who does, the number is 800-273-8255. That's 273-TALK. Of course, encourage you to take advantage of that if that's something that you need. We're talking with Steve Arkin, who is one of the founders of the Speak Up Foundation, and also with Murray Williams of the Kansas City Star. They're going to stick around, and when we come back, we'll talk with some experts who are working in our schools to address the problem of teen suicide. How do educators talk about something so sensitive and so important with the young people they want to protect from harm? I'm Brian Ellison, KCUR Central Standard. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Gina Kaufman. Today on KCUR Central Standard, we're exploring the causes, the warning signs, and the broad efforts in our community to prevent teen suicide. If you have questions about teen suicide in our area, or if you yourself have confronted some of these issues in your life and your family and want to share that, we'd be honored to hear from you. You can give us a call at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Murray Rose Williams, education reporter for The Star, is here along with Dr. Steve Arkin from Speak Up Foundation. And also joining us now are two staff members from the Kansas City Public Schools. Molly Ticknor is Director of Behavioral Health Services. Molly, welcome.
Thank you. Welcome.
And also Edward Scott Jr., who is a school social worker, and he's joining us by phone. Edward, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Molly, let me start with you. I've heard that there was a time when school districts wouldn't talk about suicide, maybe because they were afraid it would cause others to be copycats. Is that still the policy?
I think now we're becoming more aware that talking about suicide and mental health issues in general is actually very healthy. And the research shows that the more you talk about it, the less the stigma is there, and actually opening the door for youth and adults to have an open dialogue and create more of a safe environment. So I believe that culture is changing across the country, and especially at Kansas City Public Schools.
So what have the Kansas City Public Schools done to create, as you say, a safe environment? What are the elements of that?
Sure. Well, we've really worked and trained our staff, our teachers and our counselors and all of our support staff and administrators on what is mental health, how can they help support the students, how can they help support each other. We have, we're in our fourth year of creating trauma-sensitive schools, which really brings about the topic of trauma and how it impacts everyone's ability to learn, teach, and develop relationships and create more of a sensitive environment that fosters safety, fosters trust, to build those connections, that sense of belonging. And what we know is if you feel like you belong, you're more apt to want to talk to people and share your feelings, whether it's feeling depressed or anxious.
And is that something that happens in the classroom? Are there particular like educational units
is no curriculum. It's really just a state of mind. It's a culture change of the climate of the school. But it is taught at all levels. It's something that is for the janitor, for the cafeteria worker, for the students, for the parents, all the way up to our superintendent and board. So it becomes part of the school culture.
I know that you've got a particular protocol, a way for people to recognize a risk.
Mm-hmm. Yep. We have developed in the past couple of years a pretty robust suicide screening and prevention. So not only do we train and educate our staff on what are the warning signs, what to look for, how to be there and how to respond, but we've created a suicide screening so that all of our counselors, nurses, social workers, and administrators in our buildings have a series of questions to ask when a student seems as though something is not right, or if they vocalize that they want to hurt themselves, which as well as a pretty robust flowchart of a protocol of here's what to do when, so that regardless if I'm not a mental health professional, I know how to access the supports and what to do if it is imminent, if a child is suicidal based on the outcome of the screening, versus if the child is feeling some anxiety but doesn't feel like they are imminently going to harm themselves, we still have procedures and plans in place to help support our students.
Those are tools for anybody in the school system to use. Edward Scott, you're a school social worker, so you're dealing with these pretty directly and specifically. What do you do?
Well, the first, yes, I do deal with them quite often, and I think that the first thing that I do is I try to collect as much information as possible from the person that's referring the student to me, just to try to get some insight around how it is that they became aware of the student's concerns and thoughts, because then that gives me some background so that when I do go into the conversation with the student and I begin to ask the questions, I'm asking them with a little bit of context, because in situations where students express suicidal ideation, as a provider, the first thing you have to do is try to build this rapid rapport so you can get the student to answer these questions as honestly as possible, and you know, to try to create a safe space so that you can begin to talk about these thoughts and try to help them understand that this is not something that they're alone in, that there are numerous people, whether it's young or adults, that have these thoughts about what they want to do with their lives, whether or not they want to commit suicide or what have you. And the idea is how do we have a conversation that effectively shifts their thoughts and gets them to see hope in their future.
And how do you do that? I mean, it's one thing to be able to know what the signs are, or to at least have a concern. How do you build, as you said, the rapid rapport? Is it something that any adult should be able to do, or is this a time to call in the professional social worker like yourself?
Well, ideally, right? So if I could wave my magic wand, it would be something that any adult is capable of doing, because quite simply, any person is capable of listening, and any person is capable of affirming, like affirming the emotions and affirming the feelings that can sometimes be overwhelming. But the reality is that that's not always the case, that there are some people who, when they hear words like suicide, the stigma that's wrapped around it, they kind of freak out. And so in those instances, we say, hey, yeah, it's okay to go ahead and call for a counselor, or call for that social worker, if you don't feel like you're equipped to handle that conversation in a healthy way for you or the individual who's experiencing the suicidal thought.
Steve Arkin, as someone who's not a professional social worker, how do you encourage parents or other adults to build that, quote, rapid rapport?
I think the main thing is the conversation, and to begin, and to not trivialize anything that the child is saying. It's to take it at face value and to really be able to listen, to do active listening to what is going on, and to ask the questions, open-ended questions about how they're feeling about things, and not to simply flip it off as something that's, oh, it's just a teenager. Is to really delve into that and know what your resources are, so that if you do find something that's going on, is that then you're able to get other people involved in that community effort that I was talking about.
Murray, as you're listening to what some of is happening in the Kansas City public schools, are there differences in how different school districts address these issues?
There are differences in how different school districts address it. For example, Blue Springs School District has, through the entire district, all their schools, they have a program in place. Some school districts are dealing with it at the high school level, middle school level, and maybe not so much at the elementary school level. I think a lot of the districts are just starting to get on board with these efforts. I was really impressed to hear that Kansas City Public Schools has been doing this for 4 years. That's great. So yeah, there are differences in from district to district.
I mean, I want to ask all of you, in fact, are there are differences between districts in terms of the student population. There's differences of race, there's differences of socioeconomic status. How different is the problem depending on those things, or are these issues really the same regardless of which young people we're talking about?
I don't know whether the issues are the same, but I can tell you that my research showed that the numbers are different. In general, African-American community is like 2.5% less likely to commit suicide than, for example, our white community. And so if you look at that and you compare a school district where they're predominantly African-American, it may show that they're less likely to have that situation in their schools. I don't know why, but that seems to be what the numbers say.
Kansas City Public Schools, Molly, have a higher percentage of people of color than, say, some of these Johnson County school districts, where we read some of those stories from Marie's reporting.
Yeah, we've actually had a pretty consistent report of youth all the way from elementary to high school express the desire to want to harm themselves. We've been pretty fortunate about students not being successful in committing suicide. However, I will say that I think, like my colleague just shared, that there is somewhat of a stigma to suicide in some of the cultures within that make up the Kansas City metro area, and especially in KCPS. However, I think that although the issues might be different depending on your socioeconomic status and where you go to school, I believe that if you look at the research, that suicide is growing amongst a lot of different populations and a lot of different cultures and socioeconomic statuses. So I think it's just depending on where your belief system is in terms of if suicide is an option. What we do know about suicide, regardless of your race and your culture and your socioeconomic status, is if you have experienced suicide in your family or within your close network of friends, you are 55% to almost to 60% more likely to think it out as an option because you saw it as an option in someone that was close to you. Mm. So we do know that, and that's regardless of the culture and their race.
That's Molly Ticknor. She's Director of Behavioral Health Services in Kansas City Public Schools. We want to invite you to join the conversation at 816-235-2000. 2388. That's 235-2888. And let's talk with Alvin, joining us from South Kansas City. Hello, welcome to Central Standard.
Well, good morning to everyone, and thank you for the conversation. A couple of points, if I might, Mike. First of all, one of the things that I've found is with the Ad Hoc Group Against Crime, we had a youth helpline, and we had kids calling who were gay and are lesbian, and their families were so religious that they criticized them. They're going to hell, you're going to burn, you can't go to heaven. And we had kids who were threatening suicide. Another point is that African-American gay males, among African-Americans, gay males are the highest in terms of suicide, again, based on how the family looks at lesbianism or homosexuality and their religion. And I think that, and I congratulate all those schools there. I happen to be on the Hickman Mill School Board. I'm certainly going to see what our policy is here in South Kansas City at Hickman Mill School District. But I just wanted to mention those two points. One final point is that when I was a police officer back in the late 50s and early 60s, there was this fad, I use that word not advisedly, but for lack of another at this time, where there was kind of a thing going where kids were going getting into cars. And I remember on Cliff Drive, if you're familiar where Cliff Drive is, I was riding that district, and it was a car there with the motor running, and I ran up on it, these kids were in the back seat with the motor running and committed suicide by carbon monoxide. So, I mean, the conversation is timely. I appreciate the conversation, and I appreciate particularly the Kansas City School District, which is the largest school district in the on this side of the line. So yeah, that's my comment.
Appreciate it. And, of course, Alvin Brooks, not just Alvin of South Kansas City, but city council member and police commissioner and now on the Hickman Mills School Board. Thanks so much for calling, Mr. Brooks.
Thank you. God bless.
And let me ask you, Edward Scott, let me ask you about one particular group that that Alvin Brooks mentioned there. LGBTQ young people are often reported to be at higher risk, and he mentioned specifically gay kids of color. Do you, in your experience, think that that is a group that is especially at risk?
Yes, absolutely. Both in my own practice experience as well as in my research, we know that when we talk about the LGBTQIA, I'll say plus population, what we're talking about are populations that are often stigmatized by virtue of their identity, right? And so a lot of times when you have a group of individuals who are being oppressed based off of something that is immutable, that they cannot change, it creates a space where there's a negative outlook on future and on life. And then there are thoughts of self-doubt, which then leads to just this wavering sense of self-worth that often can spawn into depression and suicidal ideation and a variety of other mental health challenges. So, yes, LGBT youth plus a variety of other demographics do experience those challenges particularly.
And so let me ask all of our guests, what do you do in a situation like that? Because honestly, there are potentially going to be challenges in life for LGBTQ kids as they grow up. How do you create a sense of safety and connection in the face of things that really are hard?
Right. So from a from the standpoint of whether it be race or romantic orientation or what have you, the key is to create strong, healthy, supportive relationships and to place those youth within affirming environments where they're able to explore and develop positive conceptualizations of their identities, right? So when I begin to explore what it means to be gay, what it means to be lesbian, what it means to be Black and in poverty or what have you, and I'm not sort of demonizing or stigmatizing or otherwise placing a deficit lens on those identities, but I see them as opportunities to demonstrate resilience and to navigate the resources to be able to overcome the obstacles that are associated with those identities, then that's when we begin to see improvement, because we're getting people to feel empowered, and we're putting those protective factors in place because they understand their environments and the challenges in their environment, and then ultimately how to navigate those challenges to live thriving lives.
Makes sense.
As a reporter, and as a reporter covering education, I think that, you know, my role is to write about the very things that Edward was just talking about, and to write about these various communities of youth in a very positive light, and to show them as active, supportive, contributing parts of our society. That I see that as my role here.
Mm-hmm. And I guess I'm curious from the rest of you. Are there ways that specific groups are being reached out to in the community?
The way that we're doing it is through the UBU portion of Speak Up. And what that's all about is that message of inclusion. So what we've done is we've had these kids in the schools take on the program for themselves, and they've actually produced these videos where you see people of different races and different backgrounds who are able to come together, and they have such positive, powerful messaging through their videos that they've developed to basically include everybody so that there is differences, but there's many similarities.
I want to give the number again for the National Suicide Hotline. That's a 24/7 number that people of any age can call if they are considering suicide and they need to talk to someone. 800-273-8255. That's 273-TALK. There's also a text line available if you'd rather not talk by voice but talk by text message. You can text 741-741 to speak with a trained counselor from the National Suicide Hotline. Let's take another call from Uziel in Midtown. Uziel, thanks for calling.
Thank you so much for having me on here. Wonderful program. First of all, I want to applaud all the efforts done by all the individuals with you there. Speak Up and KCPS, hello, Dr. Arkin. We know each other well, as we've worked on at least one effort to get the word out within the Latino community. My question is, our family has gone through this tragedy as well with Uziel Jr. And my own kids are home right now because of a school day, of a snow day, and they're listening with me, being the nerd that I am. And they want to know when this conversation is going to be included, because they, as Dr. Arkin has said, we have to listen to our children at face value. They've never heard a conversation either at Foreign Language Academy or at Lincoln, where my kids have gone for the last, 20 years. Now, they have heard about bullying. They have been spoken to about drugs and sexual harassment, but I asked them if they've heard anything about this, and they said no. So I want to know when they're going to finally get this out to the kids.
Thanks for your call, Uziel. Appreciate it. And Molly, let me ask you, I mean, how do you bring this message to kids? As you said, it's not a curriculum piece. It's a state of mind, but is there a curricular element?
We are actually just starting to have this conversation, honestly, at Lincoln College Prep with the leadership there on bringing a youth-focused curriculum called Zero Suicide into our classrooms, where the youth will learn the same kind of information that our staff are learning in terms of what are the warning signs, what can I do as a peer, as well as bringing in youth empowerment kind of programs, where one of the things I will tell you that when I first came to the school district, there was a group of youth at Lincoln College Prep who for their they have a project they have to do every year before they graduate, and they did a series of PCAs on mental illness and bringing to light some of the pressures that the students are going through because of the high academically driven focus at Lincoln College Prep and the anxieties that that bring, and really being light and creating a support network amongst their peers. And so I think the work is being started informally, but formally we will be starting to bring this information to the youth. What we want to see is the youth to drive this movement. Because oftentimes, I think I heard earlier that the youth don't feel comfortable going to an adult in this school. They don't want it to be known to their peers. So maybe they're more apt to come and talk with their peers about it. And so we're creating those environments as well and those opportunities.
Very quickly, we're very short on time, but Ron for Kansas City had a question about bullying. What is being done to prevent bullying to the degree that is shown to be connected in some cases?
Yeah,
we're
definitely treating that as much like what we're doing with the suicide. Educating our staff and our coworkers and our kid and our students on what bullying is, what is okay and what is not okay, and what supports are available, creating that wraparound healthy support system on how to bring it to light, and also to to really advocate for our students when they come and they say that they're being bullied, that we take that seriously and we investigate and create those supports. And so it's much like what we're doing with the suicide movement.
It's Molly Ticknor. She's Director of Behavioral Health Services in the Kansas City Public Schools. We are also joined by Edward Scott Jr., a social worker with KCPS, Marae Rose Williams, who covers education for The Star, and Steve Arkin, who is the founder of Speak Up Foundation. Thanks to all of you for being part of a really important conversation. Thank you.
Thanks, Brian.
Thank you.
You can listen back to this show, including our earlier conversation about undeveloped land. It's all at kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, Gina Kaufman will be back. We'll talk about why we should care about birds. This show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Coy Duggar, and Suzanne Hogan, with help from our intern, Matt Groby. I'm Brian Ellison. Stay tuned now for Up to Date, coming up next.